plates of an air capacitor, and if I do something to negate the fringing effects, and I measure the capacitance, and then I put a slab of material between those two plates, and if my capacitance goes up four times higher, I will say that that material has a dielectric constant of 4. I will say that that material has a permittivity of 4. So, very similar to the way I measure permeability of a magnetic material, I can measure permittivity of an electrostatic material. Now you're going to differentiate that with permissivity. Go ahead.
Yes, just like permeability is the property of the making the electromagnetic field uniform, permittivity is basically what makes the charge uniform between two plates.
Okay, I've got a bit of a feeling now for permittivity and permeability. I've heard some words that I can't relate as to permissivity. Go ahead.
Okay, before, when you were talking about taking a bar of material and sliding it through a coil, originally you were referring to that as coupling. But the point at which the electrostatic field, which is the current running through the wire, and where the electromagnetic field becomes uniform at that one spot, that's the point of permittivity. Permissivity.
I've got a great big solenoid coil. Let's say it's 3 inches in diameter. And down the center, the axis of the coil, I'm putting either magnetic materials, and the increase in the inductance, I call that permeability, or the part of the permeability effect, because the total magnetic path is certainly involved. If I put a chunk of, if I put a brass rod, a half-inch diameter brass rod down this 3-inch diameter solenoid coil, I will be doing the equivalent of shorting out some of the turns partially. The inductance of the coil will go down when I do that. I've now put in there a material that has a permeability that is lower than unity. The eddy current effect on the brass rod going down that solenoid coil, even though it's far away from the coils, the turns of the coil, I'm not getting very much capacitive loading, so that's a second order effect. But I will get a lower inductance because of the shorting effect. The rate at which I can change the magnetic field inside of the brass rod is a hell of a lot slower and lower than it is in air. So it has a permeability lower than air. Are you saying less than unity permeability is a kind of permissivity or negative permissivity? Try to relate that one there, Glenn. Go ahead.
The material itself that creates the uniform electromagnetic waveform has permeability, or mu, right? Permissivity is the point at which, or the ability to go from the electromagnetic field to electrostatic, or electrostatic back to electromagnetic. So in other words, when you're sliding a piece of ferrite, you're basically improving the permissivity at that point. And if you're putting the brass in there, you're making it worse. Does that make sense?
When I go from a permeability of air to a lower than unity permeability, which I call brass, are you calling that lower than unity permissivity? Go ahead.
It has an effect on it, but it's not exactly. It's basically better to analyze it from looking at basically from air to higher permeability of material. But there is an effect on that, but that's actually getting into something different.
Okay, if I use a material that has a mu of 50, and I put this ferrite rod down the solenoid coil, the inductance of the coil will increase. And I think you're saying it's a certain increase in permissivity. If I take the exact same material and extend it into a loop around the outside of the coil, so I've now got a toroid of the exact same permeability material, but I've now got a much more defined total magnetic path. That will have the equivalent of more permeability. It'll have a greater increase in inductance of the coil. I think you're saying that that longer path magnetic material is now creating in that solenoid coil higher permissivity. Is that what you're saying?
That uniformed path length, there was, the coil is the cross-sectional area. Now the material itself has got a path length. When you wind up with more unified path length, that is permissivity.
More unified path length. When I took the rod and extended it and made it into a complete circle around the outside, it's not only going down the center of the solenoid, but it's also going at least one path around the outside. I've now lowered the total magnetic path length. Have I made a more permissive magnetic path when I closed the loop of that ferrite material? Go ahead.
You got it. Permissivity. That's right. In other words, it's basically permitting the electromagnetic path to become more uniform. It's basically guiding it. It's like the path that that the electromagnetics are flowing through. So in other words, you're going from an electrical energy into a magnetic energy. It's like you were referring to it before as a coupling point, where it's being coupled in, and it's making it's more permissive for the electrical path length.
Never heard of such.
So I think you're telling me now that total permissivity of a magnetic path is a function of the mu of the material, the cross-sectional area of the material, and the total path, magnetic path length of the material. The combination of path length, cross-section, and mu of material combined defines the permissivity of that magnetic path. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, but with one other thing. You have to add energy to it. In other words, just by itself, in other words, path length, you know, and everything, and all of that will just give you permeability, which is B over H. But the minute you start applying electrical energy and creating the magnetic field, now you have permissivity.
What units of measurement do you use for permissivity?
Yeah, does permissivity have a unit of measurement, Glenn?
Yes, it does, but I really prefer to hold off on that one for now.
Okay. We're way beyond the bewitching hour. I'm going to stop for now. We usually stop at 12 if we got half a brain. That was TechNet number 1322 of the series that began in September of 1982. What is that, 28 years and 1 month ago. As long as these guys stay crazy and healthy, they'll be back next week and dig a little more into this. Mel, if you're still awake, you might want to say a couple words. K2KEY, K2RIW. And by the way, will I see you next Sunday at all? Over to you, Glenn. Mel.
I don't know what's on the itinerary. I'd like to. Okay, let's see what happens during the week because I'm so far behind, you know. I was laid up for a week completely. Then I came home and I was laid up another week. Actually, this is basically, if you want to say, the last couple of days I finally got out and getting some things done. So let me see what the doctor says. I've got to go back to the doctor this week for tests. And I'm keeping my fingers crossed that the worst is over. So really, that's what it all is. A number of social engagements that we've had to pass up on, and so let's see what happens this week. I'm all, like I say, it's all judged upon the report I get after I go for a whole slew of tests this week. I'm going to put me off again in another week of got to get back to doing certain things. But all right, let's see what happens. Play by ear then. All right, take care. Good night, all. This is K2KEY.
Good luck with your blood work and other tests next week, Mel. Yeah, the official celebration for the honor of the TechNet takes place next Sunday in Paramus, New Jersey, I think it is. I've got to look up what town it is. Diageo is the name of the restaurant. Bye-bye for now. See you guys later. K2REW clear.
73 is Dick, and Mel, I hope you feel better. KC2QIQ.
Keep going.
Coming to you, everybody. Hello, Charlie 2, Zulu Bell, Zulu Canyon.
Mel, best of luck with your tests. Dick, have a great evening, and we'll be talking to you next Sunday. Glenn, Go to bed. You got to go to work tomorrow. I think, right?
KZ2WGB.
Yeah, crazy enough, John. You know, I'm still answering emails till this time because you got to realize that in China they've already started their day.
We just got to move these continents to the same side of the world so we won't have this problem.
Yeah, you could forget daylight savings time being a problem. It's, we got to become a unified time, unified working time.
Oh, Glenn, enjoy. And thanks for that conversation on the permissivity. That was very educational. I wasn't aware of the intricacies in that, but thank you very much, you and Dick.
Yeah, it's kind of unfortunate we didn't have a little bit more time to discuss this, but I guess where I was trying to go with this whole thing was that, you know, when you're looking at a wire and the magnetic field around the wire, you know, the right-hand rule, and you change it with frequency, there's some interesting effects that take place. And right at the point where the wire meets the electromagnetic field, right at that point, there's everything can be calculated and it's in phase, and you can look at the E field and the H field and the B field, and you can calculate everything. But once it's in free space, all you have left is geometry. You've got the geometry of the radiation resistance in free space. You have the geometry of the electromagnetic field, you know, 4 pi, you know, times 10 to the minus 7th, you know, or cents. And you can look at all of those units and put them all together. But now the relationship of phase between, I mean, you can definitely identify B and H, but where the E field is anymore is as good a guess as anybody, because it's just a geometry at that point in an energy unit. There's no more reference to where the E field and the H field are with each other anymore. KC2QIQ, 73 is all.
73, and that was interesting. Also, the tunnel effect of the propagation pattern, because we're on Earth, that was a good point, too. All right, I'll probably talk to you down a lot, probably tomorrow. You enjoy. KC2WGB.
Yeah, 73 is John. 73 is anybody else still listening out there, the rest of the insomniacs of the world. This is KC2QIQ wishing everybody a good rest of the weekend and a good work day tomorrow, or today, actually. KC2QIQ, 73.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Amateur Radio Newsline report number 1734 with a release date of Friday, November the 5th, 2010, to follow in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. The International Space Station celebrates 10 years of manned operation, and ham radio was there for most of it. Also, Global SET 2010 takes place on November the 13th. The Department of Justice acts to collect a $21,000 fine against a Maine radio operator. And an Ohio Radio Club receives a major grant to buy new gear. Find out the details on Amateur Radio Newsline, report number 1734, coming your way right now.
From around the world, this is Newsline, Amateur Radio's independent on-the-air news and bulletin service. Now, reporting here is Fred Fovey, WHHDU.
The International Space Station marked a major milestone on Tuesday, November the 2nd. This as it celebrated the 10th anniversary of human beings living aboard the orbital outpost. Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, is in the newsroom with more.
The real story of the International Space Station's manned operations began on November 2nd of 2000. That's when an American astronaut and a Russian cosmonaut loaded side by side into the station that sits in orbit about 300 kilometers above the Earth's surface. The station's first crew was made up of Russian Yuri Gudzenko and Sergei Kirkilov, along with American commander Bill Shepard. In the intervening decade, close to 200 people, many of them licensed radio amateurs, have spent time on board the ISS and have operated the ARATAM station. The current Expedition 25 crew is made up of Commander Doug Wheelock, KB5FOC, along with NASA astronaut Scott Kelly and Shannon Walker, KD5 STXV. Also on orbit with them are Russian cosmonauts Fyodor Yurchenkin, RN3FI, Alexander Kaleri, U8MIR, and Oleg Skripachka, RN3FU. The ISS has also been a kind of hotel on orbit for visiting space tourists, including Richard Garriott, W5KWQ. He is the son of astronaut Owen Garriott, W5LFL, who was the first ham radio operator to take to the airwaves from space back in 1982, this from the space shuttle Columbia. NASA Administrator Charles Bolden was to have begun the event speaking to the ISS crew at 9:15 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. His remarks and the following news conference were broadcast live on NASA television. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, still wishing that I could visit the ISS, I'm Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, reporting from the newsroom in the City of Angels.
In addition to the crew news conference, NASA is updating the contents of the International Space Station section of its website in recognition of the 10th anniversary. The update supports the ongoing transition from station assembly to utilization. It now will focus on the research of the unique microgravity environment of low Earth orbit as it's found aboard the ISS. A second ham radio station will soon be on the air on board the International Space Station. This after NASA approves use of the original VHF and UHF Ericsson handheld radios from the Russian module for use in the U.S. segment of the orbital outpost. A new power cable for the Ericsson radios is being delivered to the ISS. The second station is planned to initially use the same frequencies currently used by the Kenwood D700 amateur radio transceiver. Studies are underway to determine a compatibility operating plan which would allow both stations to operate simultaneously. We will have more ham radio space news later on in this week's Amateur Radio Newsline report. The second global simulated emergency test of 2010 is slated for Saturday, November the 13th, from 1100 to 1500 hours local time in the geographic region of the stations taking place. Also known by the acronym Global SET, the operation will take place on or near the established worldwide center of activity emergency frequencies on the 80, 40, 20, 17, and 15 meter bands. The objectives of Global SET are to increase the common interest in emergency communications, to test how usable the emergency center of activity frequencies are across the three ITU regions, and practice the relaying of messages using all modes. The exercise will also be used to try to create practices for international emergency communication. IARU member radio societies and emergency communication groups intended to participate are requested to register their intention through their IARU regional or national emergency communications coordinators. The 35th meeting of the Canadian Amateur Radio Advisory Board took place on Thursday, October the 28th. CARAB, as it's sometimes known, is comprised of representatives from both Radio Amateurs of Canada and Industry Canada. The latter is the regulatory agency of amateur radio in that nation. Amateur Radio Newsline's Norm Seeley, KI7UP, tells us what occurred.
Among key issues discussed at the meeting was Industry Canada's policy regarding temporary authorization of frequency assignments in amateur bands to non-amateur services, such as last September's Pro Tour race in Quebec. Radio Amateurs of Canada did all that it could to impress upon Industry Canada officials that Canadian amateurs objected to intrusion into amateur bands by non-amateur services, especially for non-emergency purposes. For its part, Industry Canada noted the objection. It also committed to improve coordination and cooperation and advised that they were sensitive to radio amateurs of Canada's concerns. Industry Canada committed to continue to work with Radio Amateurs of Canada on the National Society's request for an allocation in the 60-meter band, which mirrors those frequencies available to United States amateurs. Radio Amateurs of Canada emphasized the importance of this request as seen by Canadian amateurs. Industry Canada and Radio Amateurs of Canada also discussed the positive role that amateur radio played in emergency situations. Industry Canada noted that there would be value in more cooperation and planning between it and Radio Amateurs of Canada in this area. Follow-up meetings between the two will be arranged over the coming months. Lastly, the value of a Canadian Amateur Radio Advisory Board as a body between Radio Amateurs of Canada and Industry Canada was reaffirmed by both parties, and the terms of reference between the two were updated. Watching the story from south of the U.S. and Canadian border, Norm Seeley, KI7UP, reporting from Scottsdale, Arizona.
The next meeting of the Canadian Amateur Radio Advisory Board is anticipated for April of 2011 and will be held concurrent with the Radio Amateurs of Canada Board of Directors meeting. The Lancaster and Fairfield County Amateur Radio Club of Lancaster, Ohio, has received a $5,219.86 grant from the George and Dolly L. Zimper Memorial Fund. The grant, administered through the Fairfield County Foundation, permitted the club to purchase emergency radio gear and associated equipment that can be used at all special community events, local emergencies, natural disasters, and during other times used by the membership for training or for simulated emergency drills. The equipment will also be used to supplement emergency responders and provide education and training to volunteers who will assist those responders. The Lancaster and Fairfield County Amateur Radio Club is a public service group that has operated the KAQIK repeater on 147030 since 1976. From the United States of America, we are the Amateur Radio News Line, heard on bulletin stations around the world, including the W8LRC repeater serving Lowell, Michigan. It's taken almost 5 years, but the United States Department of Justice has gone to court to collect a $21,000 fine issued back in March of 2006 by the Federal Communications Commission to Glenn Baxter, K1MAN of Belgrade Lakes, Maine. This, as two U.S. attorneys filed a complaint in the U.S. District Court in Maine against Baxter for not responding appropriately to the order that he pay the fine that was issued for his alleged violation of several sections of the Part 97 rules. Amateur Radio Newsline's Burke Hicks has the details.
The complaint was filed October 25th in the U.S. District Court in Maine by United States Attorney Thomas E. Delahanty and Assistant U.S. Attorney Evan Ross. It seeks to force Glenn A. Baxter, K1MAN, to pay the $21,000 fine, along with a $350 court filing fee, and other relief as the court deems just and proper. According to the court documents, the fine had originally been levied because the FCC had determined that the defendant made willful and repeated violations of sections 97.101D, 97.113, paragraph A3, of the Commission's rules. 97.101D was cited for Baxter's alleged transmitting on top of existing communications at 3.890 megahertz. And K1MAN was accused of violating 97.113A3, which prohibits communications in which the station licensee or control operator has a pecuniary interest. Baxter had also been cited for willful violation of section 97.105A, which deals with exercising proper control over his amateur station, and section 97.113B, which is a prohibition against broadcasting on the amateur service bands. Lastly, the complaint notes Baxter's failure to file requested information pursuant to an FCC Enforcement Bureau directive. It should be noted that this action to collect the $21,000 fine is a completely separate action from any further sanctions the FCC might take regarding the renewal of his amateur license and the K1MAN call sign. His renewal request had been in legal limbo since his license was set aside by the regulatory agency before its expiration date back in October of 2005. Under the terms of a set-aside, an amateur service license holder can continue to operate until the matter has been properly adjudicated. Payment of his fine or forfeiture would have no bearing on Baxter's renewal or his continued holding of an FCC license. The action to collect the $21,000 fine was brought under Section 503B of the Communications Act of 1934 and Section 1.80 of the FCC Rules and Regulations. As noted, the original FCC forfeiture order was released March 29th of 2006. The deadline for service process would have been February 22nd, 2011, so the Department of Justice beat that date by a little over 3 months. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Bert Hicks in Los Angeles.
By now, Baxter has likely been informed that he has 20 days from the date of service in which to answer the summons. If he fails to respond, a default judgment will be entered against him in U.S. District Court, after which the government can seize whatever property is required to satisfy that judgment. Those interested can read the full text of the United States Attorney's complaint at the ARRL website at tinyurl.com/2DK3MQ, and the letters are in small case. The Federal Communications Commission has notified Rama Communications Incorporated, the licensee of AM radio station WRHB in Leesburg, Florida, of a proposed forfeiture in the amount of $25,000. This for violations of Section 73.1125A and 73.3526 of the Commission's Rules and Regulations. The Federal Communications Commission says that the violations stem from a recent visit where inspectors found that RAMA failed to maintain full-time management and staff at its radio station. It was also charged with failing to maintain and make available a complete public inspection file. The station was given the customary 30 days to pay the forfeiture or appeal the fine. For a second time, Indy police are being investigated on claims that officers are using radio frequencies without proper permission to do so. Jack Parker, W8ISH, has the details.
Apparently, some members of the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department are teaching a new lesson on how to abuse public airwaves and violate FCC rules. According to a local broadcast on one local Indianapolis TV station, some of Indy's finest are using illegal radios for chit-chat on a local school system bus frequency. This abuse of police radio power has been recorded by a former police fire dispatcher. According to John, who is a ham radio operator, the cops not only use school radio channels, but mix foul language with crosstalk about cases on which they are working. John claims he has recorded about 72 hours of what sounded like car-to-car conversations, some not fit for broadcast. This is not the first report of this cop caper. Last year, Amateur Radio Newsline investigated reports of IMPD officers illegally using amateur radios and frequencies for talk around. The police chief pulled the plug on all unofficial in-car radios and ordered their communications people to develop a legal radio system that officers could use for casual talk. Most officers rejected that offer, citing the out-of-pocket cost and the fact that any established radio channel could be monitored by the police brass. In the past year, at least one other amateur radio operator has filed complaints with FCC offices in Chicago and Washington citing improper use of radio frequencies by Indianapolis Metro Police officers. Following that complaint, some officers took the high road by earning their amateur radio license, but they soon realized they can't talk shop on amateur frequencies. The jury remains out on the solution to this touchy tactical dilemma. IMPD officials say they again are looking into the issue and will implement policy changes if needed. Reporting from Indianapolis for Amateur Radio Newsline, this is Jack Parker, W8ISH.
Now, this is not the first time that members of the Indianapolis Police Department have been found on radio frequencies where they don't belong. You may remember back to when hams found the officers chatting on both the 2-meter and 70-centimeter FM subbands back in 2009. The annual nominations for the Bill Leonard Award for Professional Media Coverage of Amateur Radio are now being accepted by the ARRL. Completed nominations are due in no later than December the 10th. Now, if you know a good media hit in the past year for amateur radio, you can nominate the author, the reporter, or the writer. Forms and information are available at www.arrl.org/Bill, B-I-L-L, dash, Leonard, L-E-O-N-A-R-D, dash, award. Portugal's Association of Radio Amateurs in the village of Moscovici are organizing this year's Exposition Ham Fair in the city of Lisbon. The gathering takes place on November the 28th and is being billed as one of the biggest events ever for ham radio in that nation. More information in electronically translated English is available online at tinyurl.com/3347BDS. And back in the USA, keep an ear out for special event station K7NRA. It will be active from 1500 to 2300 UTC on November the 17th to celebrate the birthday of the National Rifle Association. Frequencies to keep an ear on include 7.250, 14.250, and 21.330. More information, including QSL routing, is online at tinyurl.com/2FQFRPN. This is Ham Radio News for today's Radio Amateur. From the United States of America, we are Amateur Radio Newsline with links to the world from our only official website at www.arnewsline.org and being relayed by the volunteer services of the following radio amateur. Some names in the news. First is Ian Snow, VA3QT, who has been appointed as the Special Advisor to the Radio Amateurs of Canada's National Field Organization Executive Board. Snow, an original member of the National Training Resource Group, will work closely with National Traffic Systems Coordinator Hugh Lines, VA7HU. The two will initially look at ways for both Canadian ARES and the National Traffic System to remain useful to the agencies that they serve. This from both a messaging and use of technology standpoint. John Kelly, the former EI-4HS, has recently been issued the new call sign, EI-4L. This was the call that was previously held by his grandfather, John Scanlon, back in 1936. John Scanlon is described as one of the true pioneers of radio in Ireland. He was amongst the first to experiment with television in the years after World War II and was also very active on high-frequency DX. And Mike Ripacek, DK3WN, is spearheading a project that broadcasts audio streams received by amateur radio satellite operators around the world. Links to the audio streams can be found online at tinyurl.com/satsound, S-A-T-S-O-U-N-D. In the world of emerging ham radio technology, OH6BG has announced that the online HF propagation prediction service, VOACAP, is now using Google Maps for coordinate entry. OH6BG says that this should make the service even more accessible, especially for the casual user. With this new interface, the transmitter and receiver coordinates are now defined by dragging two location markers on the map. The mouse wheel or keyboard key can be used for zooming in and out, so placing the markers at exact points as accurately as possible. This makes the predictions as accurate as today's science allows. You can find this site online at online.voacap.com. The NASA safety review for IRS-SAT-1 has been completed, and with the written safety presentation and the written report approved with only one simple modification required. According to the ARS-SAT-1 team, it's expected to finalize the shipping arrangements for the satellite structure to Russia in the coming weeks. The Russian Energia Space Agency is handling the customs certification to ship the satellite overseas. When ARS-SAT-1 is shipped, Lou McFadden, W5DIV, and Mark Steiner, K3MS, will travel to Russia to assist with the final testing before the satellite is forwarded to the launch site. ARS-SAT-1 is scheduled to be set aboard the ISS aboard a Russian Progress vehicle in January of 2011 and deployed during a spacewalk in February. A second light sail spacecraft is going to be constructed. Jim Davis, W2JKV, has the details.
Louis Friedman, who is the director of the Light Sail 1 program, has announced that a backup craft to Light Sail 1 will be built. This instead of making an investment in insurance for an estimated cost of $200,000. As previously announced in July by AMSAT, Light Sail 1 is a 3 CubeSat spacecraft planned to be launched in early 2011. These will use UHF frequencies for tracking and command control stations. Georgia Tech University is leading the mission operations with Dave Spencer serving as mission manager. California Polytechnic University is supplying the CubeSat bus, avionics, and launch vehicle interface. Stellar Exploration Incorporated is actually building LightSail 1.
No date has been announced for the completion of LightSail 2. The Amateur Radio Club of the state of Guanajuato in Mexico will launch its second high-altitude ham radio research balloon on November the 30th. Called SARSEM Icarus II, the near-space balloon will carry a cross-band UHF-VHF repeater system, an APRS tracking system, temperature, voltage sensors, a flight computer, and a secondary backup system including other GPS and control systems. It will also carry a photo camera and a video camera transmitting video downlinking on 900 megahertz. More information is online at craig.remtronic.com. This is Ham Radio News for today's Radio Amateur. From the United States of America, we are Amateur Radio Newsline with links to the world from our only official website at www.arnewsline.org and being relayed by the volunteer services of the following radio amateur. The 2010 ARRL 10-meter contest will be held from Friday, December the 10th at 0:00 UTC through Sunday evening, December the 12th at 2359 UTC. Except at the peak of the sunspot cycle, 10 meters is generally a daytime band for DX, so you might not lose any sleep in the contest this year. More information is online at arrl.org/10-meter. In DX, word that DL4VM will be active portable OZ from Finn Island between May 28th and June the 18th, 2011. His operation will be on 30, 15, and 6 meters using CW and PSK. QSL via his home call sign, either direct or via the Bureau. ZL2KVR will be active as 5WOBR from Upulu Island through November the 13th. His operation will be on all HF bands using SSB and PSK-31. He plans to use a ST-857D with 100 watts into a dipole or vertical antenna, QSL via his home call sign. K2TQC, M2MF, W1NG, and K2NV are on the air portable PJ2 from Caraco through November the 11th. Activity is on the lower bands. QSL via their home call signs, please. And listen out for F4BXW as TRHGV from Libreville, Gabon, through November the 23rd. His activity will be on the HF bands using SSB, QSL via his home call sign. VK3EY will be active from St. Barthelemy Island as TO3A from November the 2nd to the 30th. Operations will be on 160 through 10 meters using CW, SSB, and RTTY. QSL via VE3EY. Lastly, K8PT will be active as C6APT from Treasure K in the Bahamas between November the 27th and December the 10th. His operation will be on 40 through 10 meters, concentrating on the 30, 17, and 12-meter bands. Modes to be used will be CW and RTTY. QSL via K8 Papa Tango. And finally this week, the Wireless Institute of Australia marked its conclusion of the VK100 WIA Centennial Special Event Operation on October the 31st. This with a special commemorative contact between WIA President Michael Owen, VK3KI, and ARRL President K. Craigie, M3KN. Let's take a listen.
This is the final contact for VK100WIA. N3, Kilo November. This is VK100WIA.
VK100WIA, this is November 3, Kilo November, N3KN, Blacksburg, Virginia, President of the American Radio Relay League. Congratulations and very best wishes as you begin your second 100 years of service to amateur radio in Australia. My name is Kay. Over.
During the contact, VK3KI told N3KN that the Wireless Institute of Australia was pleased that the special event station's final contact could be with her, and thanked the ARRL for its support and for participating in the WIA Centenarian Weekend through ARRL International Affairs Vice President Jay Bellows, K0QB. President Owen also said that the WIA is passing the baton on to the ARRL, as the league will be celebrating its 100 years in just 4 years. During this event, more than 50 Wireless Institute of Australia affiliated clubs have used the VK100WIA call sign for more than 6 months as part of the WIA's centennial celebration. With thanks to Allen Labs, AMSAT, the ARRL, the CGC Communicator, CQ Magazine, the FCC, the Ohio Penn DX Bulletin, Radio Netherlands, RAIN, the RSGB, Southgate News, and Australia's WIA News, that's all from the Amateur Radio Newsline. Our email address is newsline, N-E-W-S-L-I-N-E, at arnewsline.org. More information is available online at Amateur Radio Newsline's only official website, located at www.arnewsline.org. You can also write to us and support us at Amateur Radio Newsline, 28197 Robin Avenue, Santa Clarita, California, 91350. Please don't forget that in association with the Newark Amateur Radio Society, we are currently conducting a survey to determine where these weekly amateur radio newsline reports are replayed on the air. If you are a bulletin station that transmits these weekly newscasts, or just a listener who has the following information, we need you to supply us the call sign of the repeater or bulletin station that is making this transmission, the frequency where it can be heard, the time and day and days of the week that it is being broadcast, and the time zone and the estimated audience you think it has. Please email this information along with your name and call sign to ARN Schedule, that's ARNSCHEDULE, at gmail.com. Once again, that's ARNSchedule@gmail.com. And as always, we thank you for your assistance in this survey. For now, with Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, at the editor's desk in the City of Angels, I'm Fred Moby, WAHDU, saying 73, from Lima, Ohio, and we thank you for listening. Amateur Radio Newsline is copyright 2010, all rights reserved.
The time is 1:23 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2BL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2BL repeater.
Delete the parkway routes, you constantly hear the words
Recalculating.
Yes, recalculating route.
Recalculating. And 2EV.
Good morning, Evil Seed. I don't know. I haven't been able to figure out on my GPS, it's a Garmin, how I can, before I start moving, change the route. I haven't been able to figure that out. I know on some of the routings that I have on the computer, I can move things around. But not on my GPS in the car. Seedling?
You know, I was just using it yesterday, and weird. I had to go to Valley Stream, where I am. It says, take Glen Cove Road all the way down to, I don't know where, but somewhere to get to Southern State. I'm like, huh? Like, why don't we just take Meadowbrook? So, I think I gotta look it over. I think I gotta probably set for shortest distance instead of shortest time. So, I just took the Meadowbrook anyway, and then it said recalculating. John?
Yeah, route preferences, Gary. You gotta hit the thing, route preferences. Shortest time, shortest distance. Least use of freeways, most use of freeways. I believe that's the choices on mine. But.
Oh.
6 days left there, EB. 6 days left. You know what I'm talking about, right? So, Mr. Zippy Zeppy, I'm sure you enjoyed the Jets game yesterday. And, I enjoyed the Giants steamrolling Minnesota.
By the time I got home from the marathon yesterday, I turned on the Jets game and I'm saying, oh my God, not again. And then Sanchez went to work late in the fourth quarter, tied it up, and drove down in overtime. So I enjoyed the end, which is about all I saw. And as far as the GPS is concerned, I know about the route preferences. I'm talking about if, for argument's sake, the GPS takes me over the Frog Neck Bridge, and I prefer the Whitestone Bridge. On some of the softwares I can get on my computer, I can actually make that change. I can't until I get up to the Frog Neck Bridge, and then I have to hit detour on my GPS. John? Not Alpha 1. Seedling?
Yeah, the old detour bus. I want to get the one where you just talk to it and talks back to you. Like, yeah. That's a better one. I was looking at cars yesterday and last week. I don't know. So, yes, John, 6 more days on a Sunday morning. So, yeah, I gotta dig that stuff out. Dig it out. Anyway, it's a blustery morning, once again, and I'm just getting onto the parkway. John, over to you. 10-2-EV.
W2HCB on the south, north conduit. I think about that for a minute. Yes. That's not too much stuff to dig out there, EB. A battery is two, your HT, and that's it. HT, that's it. And whatever else you want to bring. So, it's just one of those things. So, anyway, that was troubling this morning. And, you know, the traffic report there, they're giving the report on the train situation. The Long Line RRR says they're running on time this morning after the massive upgrading of the ancient signal and switching system in Jamaica. Oh, my goodness. I don't know where they come up with ancient. It's not that old. My God.
DB?
No.
Dope.
ZEP.
W2HCB. Wasn't the switching station in Jamaica approximately 100 years old? In railroad terms, that's ancient. Like John, you will see.
Is that the pot calling the kettle black? Wait a minute, that's kind of ancient also. Anyway, that's right. We got, we still have some ancient signal systems ourselves. Somebody, I think East New York, and it's just another shop that has manual switching. So, they're supposed to be upgrading that. Well, I saw a bobcat in the parking lot Friday. It was a big truck. I think it dropped it off on Friday, and supposed to be redoing the lot a little bit, probably this past weekend. So, we'll see how it goes. How the parking situation is this morning. Anyway, John, we're going to be in our mobiles, right? We're not going to be in my HD anyway, but, you know, my better radio is the mobile radio. Over to you.
Yes, EB. You'll be in your vehicle. The only time you'll be out of your vehicle is when you have to just move the little barricade over. That's it. Then you can sit back in your vehicle. And you get out again when the last little police car goes by you. And you slide your barricade to the side of the road. And that's it. It's on. Simple.
You guys think of a backup repeater? Because yesterday, despite all the preparation for the marathon, Logistics South had to go on to the backup frequency. Our main frequency wasn't working properly. EB?
Well, simplex. When the repeaters fail, you go simplex for what we're doing.
All right, good old simplex. Yep.
Yeah, I got to dig out some sheets again. I printed them out. I'm going to put that. I've got to probably set stuff up this weekend. Saturday, the day before. Get it all set up. So I'll be good as go. Good as go. Anyway. Good. So, the good news is that they caught the number one, well, they caught one of the guys that visits our frequency that has no call sign, and now they're looking for the second guy. That's the good news. John, over to you.
They take him for a nosh?
That guy, too.
His silver bracelets?
Who you think these people are? The repeater police? Good morning, Richie. Since no one's willing to say good morning to you, I will. So, John, since you seem to be the person in the know, were these offenders caught by someone from the club or from someone from the federal government? EB?
No, by the club. Just people helping out. I mean, the latest guy was that carrier guy that hung on to a carrier. Great for radio. And, took him out for a late breakfast. I think that's sort of a notch. John?
So, did they Mosley clip him? Did they dice up his coax into little quarter-inch pieces? Did they, do a lobotomy with his HD antenna through the, nasal passages?
That's what I want to know.
Richie, pick it off and pass it over to the toothless guy.
No, they probably just shook their finger at him and gave him a stern warning and saying, tisk, 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 shame on you.
you shouldn't be doing these kind of things. And then they sent him a $5.35 return receipt requested letter.
Now, if the club is the only one who located this guy, he may say, so you know